So I have no conflict of interest, and I have trouble with the control. Okay.
Oh yeah. Can we fix these slides, controller guys?
The objective is to understand the concept of osmolarity, and tonicity. To talk a little bit about ADH, the complications that you might have with hyponatremia. We're going to start with only with hyponatremia, and the treatment for hyponatremia. Next. Okay, so what is hyponatremia? Now it's working. So hyponatremia comes, if I can get to the next one.
Just say next slide and he'll switch
next
it for
slide.
You.
Just point, you can point here.
No, I'm telling you the battery's dead, dude.
Okay, so what is hyponatremia? So just so everybody's on the same page, hyponatremia is not a disease of sodium. Hyponatremia is a disease of water. That's the first thing that needs to be clarified. Next.
Here, let me have it. I'll fix it.
Okay, so the word hyponatremia comes from a Greek root that is hypo, that means that it's below, a Latin word that means natrium, that is sodium, and emia, that is another Greek word that means that it's a substance that is present in the blood. So hyponatremia will be a sodium that is low in the blood. It's as simple as that. Next. This cartoon is trying to actually show the different types of hyponatremia. So the height of the bar is the total water volume, and the shade will give you the concentration of the sodium. So on the first one, you have on the left a normal, and on the right, next to it, you will have three different types of dehydration. You might have a dehydration in the first bar where the total water volume is less than normal, but your shade is very pale. That will be a hyponatremic dehydration. In the second one, you have a shade of red that is darker than normal, so that would be a hypernatremic dehydration. And on the last one, you can have also a isonatremic or normonatremic dehydration. There is another concept that you need to manage when you're talking about sodium, which is water intoxication. Water intoxication, the total water volume will be normal, but the concentration of sodium is low. And finally, in patients with heart failure, nephrotic syndrome, liver failure, you will have a total water content that is increased, and the sodium is diluted in that excess of water, and it will give you hyponatremic hypervolemia. Okay, so let's try to do it with a case. So a 23-year-old female presented to the emergency room with an acute change in mental status. The family admits that she has been taking ecstasy or MDMA for the past 2 or 3 days, and she went to a party. And the common knowledge in the street is that when you are doing MDMA, you have to drink a lot of water so you don't get dehydrated. So she's a good patient out of those street doctors, and she drank a lot of water in the party.
Would Gatorade have made a difference?
No, not much. So initial evaluation in the ER is giving us a sodium of 120. She does not have any alcohol in blood. She is negative for aspirin and negative for Tylenol. Okay, so the first concept when you deal with a patient with low or high sodium is the concept of osmolality, okay? A solution is a homogeneous, this is taken out of the Webster dictionary, so this is not me. It's a homogeneous mixture of two or more substances that actually will be together until they get to a limit, and they have two components, a solute, and a solvent. That solution will have several physical and chemical properties. The osmolality will be one of them. Other properties will be boiling point, freezing point, density, surface tension, specific gravity, ionization, pH, and the list keeps going and going and going. I just put some of them, okay? Now, some people say osmolarity, and some people say osmolality. Is that interchangeable or not? It's important to look at this slide, and we are talking about what is in the numerator or what is in the denominator. When we are talking about moles of solution, and you put it on the numerator, but in the denominator you use liter of solution, you're talking about molarity. But when you use as a denominator a kilogram of solvent, then you call it molality. If you're using the numerator instead of using moles, you're using osmoles, then when the denominator is a liter of solution, you will call osmolarity. And when you're using a kilogram of solvent, you call it osmolality. This is important, and I want you to remember this because I'm going to use the terms back and forth. When I'm referring to about solutions, I probably will talk about the osmolarity of the solution. When I'm talking about the patient, I will talk about the osmolality of the patient. So if you look at this substance, for example, and this is a U-tube, and this dotted line at the bottom is a semi-permeable membrane, you will see that this substance was able to cross the membranes and will distribute evenly all across. This substance A, that I'm going to call it substance A, is osmotically active, and it will move across the membrane without any problem. It has osmolarity, but it doesn't have any tonicity. That will be the term that we're going to start introducing right now. If I get another substance, that's what we were saying, is moving across. Let me try to move on. If you get a second substance, but this time the second substance will not be able to cross the semipermeable membrane, it will stay only on the A side of the tube. That substance is osmotically active, and now is going to have some degree of tonicity, because the tonicity, what it does is that actually it's going to pull the water, and it's going to create a difference in height in the water. And difference in height will be the tonic effect or the tonicity of the substance. Now, go back to the list of the physical properties of a solution. Tonicity will never, never be a physical property of the solution. How come? Well, just like height is relative. If you look at this cartoon and you see this guy A in the center, when you compare him to B, I is the little guy and B is the big guy. But if you take A and you compare him with C, you see that A is the big guy and C is the little guy. So how come A can be the big guy and the little guy at the same time? The reason is because you are saying taller or shorter when you are comparing it to somebody else. If I get this concept and I try to take this concept to a solution, then the solution A has some specific osmolarity. And when I compare it to the solution C that has a lower osmolarity, A will behave hypertonic. While if I compare A to B, B has higher osmolarity, so B will behave hypertonic to A, therefore A will be hypotonic compared to B. So now we go back to the same thing. A can be hypertonic or A can be hypotonic at the same time. Next. Maybe. Okay, so if we do the same thing with, and we call substance A normal saline, that has 308 millimoles per kilo. If you compare normal saline to some osmolality of 250, normal saline will behave hypertonic. But if you compare to a substance B that has 400 millimoles per kilo, it will behave hypotonic. Does it make any sense?
Yes.
All right. So how do we calculate this? So there is always a formula somewhere in some book. In this case, for our case, the sodium is 120. And the formula will be 2 times the sodium plus the glucose divided by 18 plus the BUN divided by 2.8. 2 times the sodium will be 2 times 120, 240. 120 divided by 18 will give you 8. If you don't believe me, just go ahead for your phones and check it. But believe me, it's 8. And 16 divided by 2.8 will give you about 2. So the osmolality of the patient will be around 250. When you are choosing the solution that you want to use for the patient, let's go back. Then the osmolality of the solution is 308 for normal saline that will behave hypertonic to the patient. And the osmolality of the potassium that you're giving to replace the potassium, if you need to do that, it will be 700, so it will behave hypertonic also. Next. Let's switch a little bit and let's talk a little bit about ADH. ADH is the antidiuretic hormone. And the antidiuretic hormone is the hormone that controls the osmolality in plasma. Okay, like any hormone, like thyroid or insulin, it is produced in one part of the body and it has its effect in another part of the body. In this case, ADH is produced in the brain and it acts on the kidneys. Next. Ooh, too much.
Back one.
The job of the water is to save water. When the hormone is present, the kidney will save as much water as possible. Here is the thing. By default, the kidney will always waste water. By default. The only way that the kidney will not waste water, because that's difficult, it's like delivering good care. It requires an effort. It requires energy. So the only way that the kidney is actually going to make an effort is that they have a police looking over him. In this case, the police is going to be the ADH. It's going to make it do really concentrated. Next one. So this cartoon actually is showing us what happens. The osmolarity will stimulate the brain, and the brain is going to release ADH to the kidney. The kidney is going to reabsorb some water and is going to produce some concentrated urine. I'm sorry, my animations are not as spectacular as yours.
Okay, they are amazing. They were not mine, sir. So yours are doing perfect.
These are very colorful.
This is these are homemade animations. So
they're amazing.
As cool as yours.
Wait till you see my animations.
Yeah. So here it is. The first case, when the osmolality in the serum is high, the brain will sense that high osmolality, ADH will be released, the kidney will make concentrated urine, and the water will be absorbed, making the concentration or the osmolality of the plasma to go down. Next. What happens when there is no ADH or the ADH doesn't work? So the osmolality stimulates the brain, but the brain does not respond to that. There is no ADH, and the kidney actually pees out all the water that it can. It will produce large amount of water. Okay? In this case, when the osmolality is low, then the brain senses low osmolality do not produce any ADH. The kidneys make diluted urine, water is wasted, and the concentration of the osmolality will go up. So this is normal. We're talking only about normal. And the way that we will remember this is, when your serum osmolality is low, your urine osmolality needs to be lower. When your serum osmolality is high, your urine osmolality needs to be higher. This is normal. Let's talk about a little bit of when it's not normal, because we're in the business of people who are not normal. If they are normal, they don't come to us. In SIADH, the serum osmolality is low. The brain will sense high osmolality. It will release ADH. The kidneys will make concentrated urine. The water is going to be saved and reabsorbed, and the osmolality is going to get worse. So that would be the pathophysiology, and I put in red the steps in the process that actually fail or are behaving abnormally, okay? If you let this run, you can always let it run. If you let it run, then you will run into the complications. And there are two types of complications of hyponatremia. The first one will be complications related to the water disturbance itself. That will be brain edema and pulmonary edema. And there will be complications related to the speed of correction. That will be CPM. Okay, let's talk about a little bit of the brain edema. So this cartoon, again, I'm sorry, you know, yours is more impressive than mine. The dark shade on the left is the inside of the cell. The light shade is outside of the cell. The semipermeable membrane is in between. The W's are water, and the red and light blue are the sodium. The system is in equilibrium because you see that the osmolality inside and outside is the same. So far, so good. What happens if the osmolality changes? Now the osmolality inside of the cell is 280 and outside is 100. And when the osmolality drops, the system is no longer in equilibrium. So what is going to happen is that molecules of water will start moving from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. And that process will continue over and over and over as the osmolality gradient exists between the inside and the outside of the cell. Once you reach a point where the osmolality inside of the cell is equal to the outside of the cell, then the flow stops. Back to equilibrium, yes, but all this water that came in actually increased the size of the cell. And if this happens in every single cell in the brain, and the brain is contained in the skull and the brain has nowhere to go, then what you have is an increase in the pressure. And you have an intracranial pressure syndrome, creating brain edema, herniation, probably death. Okay, how do we treat this hyponatremia? Well, I mean, the best way probably it would be the Adrogay-Madias formula. And if you look at the formula, this is the formula, and it looks a little bit fancy, but basically what it says is that the change in the sodium will be the change in the concentration of the sodium in the fluid that you're giving minus the concentration of the sodium in the plasma divided by the total body water plus one. If I do it for normal saline, remember normal saline is 0.9% sodium chloride, and the sodium concentration is 154. So 154 minus 120, and we're gonna make this patient a 58-kilo, 23-year-old female. About 50% of her body weight is water. So it will be 34 divided by 30. So that means that every liter of normal saline that I will give to this lady that weighs 58 kilos and has a sodium of 120 will raise the sodium by 1.13 milliequivalents. If I try to do the same thing with 3% hypertonic saline, somebody will come and say, oh, we need to give hypertonic saline because the sodium is low. Then the sodium concentration of the 3% is 513. And when we apply the formula, it gives us 393 divided by 30, and that will be 13.1, which means that if you give a liter of 3% saline, you will raise the sodium by 13.1 milliequivalents. Both formulas together. Now, let's look at both pathways. Whether you want, we're trying to make the decision here whether we should give normal saline or we should give 3%.
You have to, I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're really, if you're that low, a rapid change can create its own problems.
Exactly. So here we have both formulas, and the dose that we're going to give in a liter, the recommendation for 3% is about 100 cc's per hour bolus. It will be 0.1 liter versus a bolus of normal saline will be a liter. And that will change pretty much the same in either of the pathways. So what I want to say over here is that giving a bolus in these specific circumstances of 100 cc of 3% saline is exactly the same as giving a bolus of a liter of normal saline. If you continue and you the recommendation is to raise the sodium by 5 points when the patient has seizures or he has a change in mental status, you should go up fast by 5 points and then stop there. You will have to give 4.5 liters of normal saline or 380 cc's of 3%. And it will take you between 4.5 or 3.8 hours to correct the sodium by 5 points. So the question is how much in a hurry you are, if it's really worth it, just the half an hour between 3.8 and 4.5, just to put the central line, to get an x-ray, to verify that the central line's in the right place, to talk to pharmacy, to get all the safety steps that need to be done in the, on the 3%. Is it worth it or not when you can actually use something that is easier to give through a 18 gauge in the back of the hand or even in the antecubital? Now, the problem of being a theoretical person is that the formulas are just a guideline. So this is a very nice paper published by Stern where he actually looked at the correlation between the sodium correction that was expected by applying the formula versus the sodium correction that actually they saw on the patient. So if the patient corrects what the formula says that it was supposed to correct, you get one. If the patient corrects less, you get less than one. And if the patient corrects more, you get more than one. Okay, and you can see that this graph is totally shift to the right, which means that the patients will always overcorrect. That it means that Dr. Adrogué and Dr. Madias were wrong. No, is that the formula does not take into consideration that we're talking about three different compartments. We're talking about the osmolarity of the fluid that we're giving, the osmolality of the serum, and the osmolality of the urine. Let's take a close look at the relationship between the osmolality of the fluid and the osmolality of the urine. So when is 0.9% saline not a good choice? So in this case, when you have 0.9% saline that has 308 and you give it to the patient, but the patient is not responding and expecting and is generating an osmolality of 800 milliosmoles per kilo, the urine is hypertonic compared to the saline. And what is going to happen is that normal saline is not going to be appropriate. Why? So here you have the normal saline. The normal saline goes to the kidney. Come on, cross in there. There you go. Okay. The kidney will actually generate, in the presence of ADH, it will generate a lot of concentrated urine. And the urine is going to be eliminated, and what is left is just pure water. And the pure water is going to go back into the system and make your sodium even worse. So when is normal saline not a good choice? If the solution's osmolality is less than the urine osmolality, so the solution is hypotonic, that's a bad idea. And the cutoff point is going to be 308. When the urine osmolality is more than 308, then you should not use normal saline on this patient. On the other hand, there will be a case where you're giving 308 of normal saline, but the kidney is producing 240 or 230 of osmolality. So now the normal saline is behaving hypertonic to the urine. And in that case, what is going to happen is that you give a liter of saline. Come on, you can do it. Cross, there you go. Okay, and the kidney is going to make diluted urine, which means that it's going to take some water, it's going to take some sodium, and it's going to leave enough sodium to actually make a correction that is going to go into the system. So one is the right, when is the right treatment? It is the right treatment when the urine osmolality is less than 308, because it will behave hypertonic. Now you guys understand why I make so much effort trying to explain the big guy and the little guy and the hypertonic and the hypotonic in this case. Next. Okay, remember, any hypertonic solution, whether it's 0.9 or 3% or 2% or 5% or 23% saline, will be an acceptable choice as long as it behaves hypertonic to the urine.
There's 23% saline?
Yes. 23% is what now the guidelines use for emergency neurological life support when you have an acute emergency and your intracranial hypertension is going to kill your patient and you have to bring the pressure down. That's the right juice.
Give like 50 cc's of it? Or?
Yeah, 20 cc's, 50 cc's.
Wow. Huh? I didn't even know that existed.
Depending on the protocol. Next. Okay, so in conclusion, the osmolality is a property that belongs to the solution, but the tonicity does not belong to the solution. The tonicity belongs to the relationship between the two of them. When the osmolality is low, one must use hypertonic solutions. And using the right way, any hypertonic solution will have the same effect. Urine electrolytes and urine osmolality is critical to the management of the patient. You just cannot do this, you know, looking at the stars and feeling, looking at the position of the space station and what side of the moon is pointing at Houston or something like that. No, you actually need to measure. You need to measure on a regular basis because this is going to be a dynamic target. Your osmolality is going to change as you actually do it.
Yeah, I'm so glad we're having this discussion because, you know, we don't really spend a lot of time thinking about this. We know it. We remember it. But we don't really practice it. That's why you have to have intensivists in these critically ill patients.
That's why you have like four OR people and one poor intensivist here and
yes.
intimidated.
We were in the ICU too. That's where you know us from. We're always there with the ECMOs and stuff. We just are so focused on our little microcosm, our little silo. And this is so important, I think, for us to be thinking, you know, that we're self-limited. This is critically important that we're hearing this. Because I've got some, my talk is going to, I think, really raise, I mean, you and I are going to get into a really intense discussion about this very topic that you just talked about. So let's proceed. I'm sorry.
And finally, aggressive treatment is not always the right treatment. All right?
Good. What happened? That was it? That was your last slide?
I'm done.
Okay.
Okay, I have a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
I agree with everything you're saying, but let me tell you some external factors, which plays into that, like I said, multifactorial, plays into the formula. So fluid restriction, which is very controversial, is number one. Do you believe in fluid restriction?
No. There are many treatments of hyponatremia.
What was the question?
The question was...
Does he believe in fluid restriction?
Restriction, okay.
Fluid restriction. There are many, many, many treatments for hyponatremia. We have fluid restriction. We have... vasopressin, ADH, administration of ADH. We have administration of hypertonic saline, and we have Vaptans, tolvaptan, conivaptan. What we're talking here is the patient who is in the ICU critically ill, not the patient who is showing up on a doctor's office and the sodium is a little bit low.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a completely different management. I think that if you have a patient who is talking and is communicating and is able to eat and is able to be admitted to the floor and it will be safe in a 1-to-6 ratio, I think that fluid restriction, there's a role for that, especially if you have a hypervolemic.
Then let me ask you, add more controversy. How about fluid restriction and sodium tablets?
Sodium tablets is part of the treatment, okay? Sodium tablets, in my mind, will be more indicated when you make the diagnosis of salt wasting disease mm-hmm. versus hypernatremia. Giving sodium to somebody who is dehydrated because he has a bad case of cholera and he's having a stool that is hyponatremic. So if your stool is hyponatremic, you will become hypernatremic because you're losing more water than solute. So if you have a bad case of cholera and you try to treat it with a bag of potato chips and a salt tablet, that probably is not the best strategy. So, but if you have a total sodium deficit and you prove it and it's a salt wasting disease, then there is a role for sodium tablets. It's just that it cannot be one size fit all, and we're gonna everybody who comes over here with a sodium below 135, we're gonna give it a tablet of sodium, and everybody's gonna get better. I don't think that is that simple.
I agree with you, and I'll tell you, and not to make fun, but there's two places I deal with. One, and this is a reality. Yeah, also it's an economic reality too for both of the places. One place will treat hyponatremia with sodium tablets, pickle water. Potato chips and fluid restriction, and the other one is covaptan to vaptan, or vaptans. So,
what are those medications? I'm not familiar with them.
The vaptans are, they're called aquaretic drugs, and they call them actually aquaretic because they wanted to pretty much to keep him away from the cardiologist.
Okay. Because so they're not diuretics.
No.
They decided, a decision was made.
They are, but they're not. There are, but they don't call them that.
It's not a diuretic. It's an aquaretic. It makes you lose free water.
Exactly.
Okay.
Really fast. And the reason why it's not classified, yes.
Kind of like a diuretic does.
But it's free water.
Right.
It's free water.
Not salt.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
While Lasix will actually, you will lose
sodium. You're inhibiting
sodium.
The reabsorption of sodium and the loop of Henle and all that stuff. So your water excretion is because you're losing sodium and the water goes along with it. Whereas with aquaretics, you're only losing water, not the electrolyte that it's dissolved in to go out.
Yes.
Okay.
Closing. Yes. So there are many treatments.
How does it do that?
For hypopigmented treatment.
How does it do that?
Well, I think that, again, how many hours do we have for this?
How does it do that? I just want to know how it does that.
I'm the bad person now, Magic, not him.
There are two receptors that actually they deal with free water in the kidney, in the nephron. And if this just like any other medication is an agonist or is an antagonist, okay? And they go in there and they are highly effective. You can actually do a serious change in the water concentration, the osmolality of the patient with the aquaretics. But right now, there seems to be a consensus that there is no role for Vaptans in acute hyponatremia.
Okay, and they're called Vaptans,
V-A-P-T-A-N-S.
V-A-P-T-A-N, Vaptans.
Even IV?
Tolvaptan is IV.
Covaptan is AMPL.
I think that you will be seriously criticized if you try to manage an acute hyponatremia with Tolvaptan.
No, I'm sure, but I just don't even
I'm going to have to say, it depends on the institution. To be honest with you, I cover an institution where it's encouraged to take PO and ICU, move in and move out faster. It's just the reality of it. And you know, I worked in Memphis for a long time. And I know the realities of high level critical care, but I have to tailor my critical care to the institution and the economic realities where I am. So that economic reality is where you are dealing with the ICUs that encourages using PO quickly. So you get in and out. That's like using Entresto instead of Marinol. I mean, that's another example I'll give you. And from those examples, I can go over on and on and on. I mean, and there's some realities in the world. There is ICUs that cannot afford, you know what I'm saying? And they want to get the patient, PO easy in, easy out, and get them on the floor quickly. So that's just being the realities.
Okay. So my talk, I've changed it from what's on that card, because that's going to be on December 10th. And it's going to be on CRRT, a topic that you and I have already had a brief discussion on. And I've got some pretty strong views about that. And in light of all of this that you talked about, I think it's going to be a very interesting, controversial, if you will, because I tend to like controversy. I don't know if you noticed that about me or not, but I do like it.
Really?
And I want to get the thoughts of Sharon, who has good experience with it, Becky, you have good experience with it, and talk about its involvement in not only the ECMO patient for a whole other variety of reasons, but also, you know, getting out the evil humors and all these other, you know, the bad juju, the gree-gree, whatever you want to call it.
The inflammatory.
But also inflammatory mediators.
That's what you meant, you know, with all
and
that.
And also in fluid balance status and electrolyte disturbance correction. So I'm real interested to give my talk. It's going to be brief. My talk is very brief.